I'd like now to introduce Nicolasa Chavez. She is curator of the New World Cuisine exhibit, which opens on Sunday, December 9th at the Museum of International Folk Art and will be up until January of 2014. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So how did you get the idea to do a folk art show about food and cuisine? It goes back centuries.
It does go back centuries, and part of it is just my passion for food history and local history here in New Mexico, and the artifacts that the museum holds in its collections that reflect food culture and the use of food and items that are made specifically for preparation, serving. And growing up here, learning about the history early on, certain items were used throughout the Americas or back in Spain, and tying that connection to New Mexico is a very important part of the exhibit.
Now, are all the objects from this geographical area, pretty much?
No. Actually, in the exhibit, we have items from Spain, from Argentina, Peru, Chile, Bolivia, Mexico, New Mexico. So a little bit from all over. We even have something from Japan in the exhibit.
Where did all these objects come from? I mean, you have a vast collection at the Museum of International Folk Art.
Yes, well, a big chunk of our collection is the Alexander Girard collection, which is over 100,000 pieces. The museum's total collections hold about 130,000 pieces. Various donations throughout the years. Another big one was the Neutrogena donation that came in from Lloyd Coltson. The Houghton Sawyer collection of Mexican Maiolica is a big part of the exhibit I'm doing right now. And also I'm purchasing through the years and acquiring things via gift. In this exhibit, we have a few items on loan from other institutions. However, about 95% of the show is our collection at the museum.
So food is all about not only mixing foods together, but mixing cultures together. And that's really represented in this show.
Yes. Yes. The show largely concentrates on the Spanish colonial period and something titled the Columbian Exchange, which is, it's called that after Columbus, but most of the exchange happened after he landed here in the Americas. But he did take some of the first American foods back to Europe, taking them into Spain on his first return voyage in 1493. However, the exhibit talks about food mostly in our part of the world and in the Americas, but also what American foods influenced Europe, how those foods spread throughout the world. So it is largely what I like to call culinary mestizaje, or the mixing of food items and showing the mixing of culture through that food history.
What are some of those New World foods that were brought back to Europe?
New World foods, the main one, chocolate, which is the popular food in the exhibit. However, items like vanilla. Europe and the rest of the world had not known vanilla before. It's native to Mexico and was used there and grown there. Other food items, South America, you have the tomato, the potato, things that drastically changed how cultures cook, prepare, and use food. The tomato's a main ingredient in so many cuisines around the world. However, it was an American food, so prior to 1492, there was no tomato, say, in Italian cooking, no tomato in Spanish gazpacho.
Right, and it's almost hard to believe. I mean, what were the European foods that they were eating that then came over here?
Over here, a lot of the spices from the spice route, Mediterranean food, your onions, your garlic, figs, citrus, oranges, lemons, all our peach and apricot trees here in New Mexico came via the Spanish. Quince is another one that came over. Also herbs, different herbs and spices, so lavender and rosemary, two things that rosemary down south in New Mexico grows like crazy. Lavender, of course, up here. There's a lot of lavender farms. Those sorts of items came via the Spanish from Europe over.
Now, let's talk for a moment about the all-important chili. Where is that from?
The chili is largely originated more around the equator in kind of the semi-arid climates just above and below. However, it's a plant that really grows and prospers and reproduces well via birds and human. So it was cultivated in Mesoamerica, even though that wasn't the origin. It was further south than Mesoamerica. But by the time the Spanish arrived, it was being grown extensively throughout Mexico. And The people are studying right now whether it was actually grown in New Mexico prior or traded into New Mexico prior to the Spanish. Archaeologists are out there studying and trying to find if those origins are there. We've recently found that chocolate was here. A lot of the general perception was a lot of the foods from Mexico were brought up the trail when the Spanish arrived. And, of course, they were brought up in larger quantities and numbers probably. But the trade was happening prior to that time, so chili could have been used here as well. And again, chili's one, it's an American food specific to the Americas. Every variety of chili or bell pepper, and then it spread throughout the world and became such a part of Asian cuisine that people often think the chili pepper came from Asia, when in reality it is from the Americas.
There's a lot of focus in ecological circles on invasive species. When you transport something from one place to another, it can really mess up an ecosystem of another place.
Right.
But you're kind of, I mean, it seems like you're talking about foods here that just did fine and made everybody's lives better.
Yeah, foods that did well. I assume, you know, foods that didn't do well probably weren't grown or people gave up on them and tried not to use them. It is interesting because certain foods that did travel, say, over to Europe and spread weren't accepted right away. For example, the tomato was viewed with suspicion at first. It was this very odd food, and it was also a member of the nightshade family, which could be deadly. So people were very cautious about using the tomato. It wasn't like, oh, there's this great food, and let's add it to everything right away. It took several hundred years for a lot of these foods to catch on and become a part of the regular diet. And today, when we think of chocolate, you know, we love chocolate, but originally, chocolate was bitter. It was served with chili. It was this really thick, kind of weird consistency. So again, some of the first writings about trying chocolate for the first time, people thought it was disgusting. And eventually, though, it caught on somehow. Like, people noticed there was a value to it. It was sustenance, and it really did carry you through the day. It was used as a food, even though it was a liquid, but it had a lot of nutritional value. The antioxidants that, you know, now again science and health magazines are saying, oh, there's antioxidants in chocolate. Well, ancient Mayans just somehow instinctively knew that and used it. But that one took a while to catch on too. And again, when it went back to Europe, it got accepted more into wealthy society, court societies, the churches. But largely people were looking at it for medicinal qualities. A lot of times foods entered into the, you know, the food chain via medicine. Like, what are the qualities in this food? What's its use for? What's its purpose? And then it becomes a part of the everyday. But it takes a long time.
Now, did chocolate become more palatable to people who weren't used to it when sugar was added, when it was sweetened?
Yes. With sugar, every sort of spice you can think of was added to it, and hundreds of different concoctions, trying different things, using anise or allspice, or even adding musk to it or rose water. So again, it was this whole time of experimentation where in Europe you had the Mediterranean cuisine, you had spices from the spice route, you had food native to Europe. So everything was getting mixed and tried in different concoctions. So the same thing happened with chocolate. So during this time of experimentation, let's say, and again, medicinally, the humorous system was the big thing in Europe, where things were either termed as hot or cold, and based on what your body composition was, certain things could be taken into the body based on that. So if you have a more cold system in your body, you want to counter that and use different foods. So experimenting with herbs and spices within chocolate definitely made it more palatable. I imagine some of those concoctions weren't too great.
Right.
Others obviously stuck and were really good, and they found that sugar worked well with chocolate. Vanilla, always used in chocolate. And then adding milk to it. Prior to the arrival of the Spanish, there wasn't dairy in the Americas. So the cows coming in, the use of milks, creams, cheeses, that sort of thing, transferred over to the Americas, and milk entered into chocolate. And when we think of hot chocolate today, you know, American hot chocolate's kind of this watered down, you know, it's a cocoa powder, you mix it with hot water or hot milk. But historically, it was a very thick and frothy drink. So, and even today in Spain, when it's served, it's almost like a warm pudding. It is so thick, you could use a spoon. Hence, people always talk about chocolate and churros. Well, it would just stick to a churro, which is, you know, a type of donut that's long and skinny, and you can stick it into your drink. But it's a really thick drink, so it sticks right onto bread very nicely. So historically, again, it was this really thick, rich drink, and it just held you over between that time of day where there's lunch and the dinners were way later at night. In Spain, it's a light snack versus your big lunch in the middle of the day, but the chocolate was something that sustained you throughout the day and kept you going.
How do we know what people ate 2 and 3 and 4 and more hundred years ago?
Well, through documents, one, through historical documents and through old historic recipe books, medical journals, private journals of people writing about things they've just tried for the first time. When we're talking about foods of the Americas, when you go into ancient times, you can look at glyphs. There's Mayan glyphs for chocolate. There's actually murals showing the serving and preparation of chocolate and plates of items that look like tamales that probably have an early form of mole sauce on it. And then when the Spanish arrived, and this is true of all over the world, so not just the Spanish coming in, but the Portuguese traveling and the British traveling, people were studying everything they saw and found. So there are these wonderful descriptions of some of these foods, early botanical drawings, what these foods look like. Again, they're out documenting, exploring, researching, and then bringing this information back to the home country and trying to show what a tomato is to people, dissecting it, showing the insides, showing the plant, showing the seeds. So the botanical drawings and the early scientific research is really important when studying the history of food.
We tend, I think, to focus when we're doing history on conflicts and wars and things like that. And it seems like what you're doing in this show is showing a medium wherein there's a whole lot of peacemaking. In other words, when people sit down together at a table and share food, that's a way of actually getting along across cultures.
Yes, I think the big part of the exhibit for me is that it is a positive show, which, again, like you said, there's a lot of history about war, conflict, this sort of thing. But we're all here today, and one of the reasons we are here is because of the mixing that does happen or the exchange that does happen. There's a reason we have survived. And I think food does play a big part of that. And it also reflects the culture that you're in. So you have these individual cultures with their specific cuisine, but then you have this mixing. Hence, in New Mexico, there's a reason our cuisine is so unique, and you know, within the U.S., but it's also different than Mexican cuisine. Mexico has a lot more seafood. There's a lot more tropical things that can grow. You know, avocados can grow down there, citrus, pineapple, whereas up here, certain things took to the land better and well. We have to import a lot, obviously, because we do serve guacamole at every New Mexican restaurant, but it doesn't grow here, the avocado. But the chili and the way it's prepared in New Mexico is very different to what it tastes like and the way it's prepared down south. So we have a very specific regional cuisine, which I think showcases a positive outcome of what happened when two cultures met. And I really shouldn't say two cultures, because there were many cultures here prior.
Do you have records of people actually, Spanish and Indian, for example, sitting down together and sharing food and what that was like?
Not a lot. There are some. And, you know, one main one I can think of is after the Pueblo Revolt, when de Vargas came back in with the Spanish colonists again, they did have peace talks and attempt to come back peacefully, and they did serve chocolate during those talks as kind of the mediating drink there.
Right.
So that's one of the big examples in history where the food was used in that manner.
Now, in this show, you're not actually having, you can't really put food in the exhibit.
So right.
Tell us about some of your favorite and some of the highlight objects in the exhibit.
Okay, highlight objects. This show's been a wonderful show to work on because I think I love every object in the show. We have close to about 350 objects, give or take. It's divided into sections, and what we did in the exhibit was we included historic renditions of kitchens and home and hearth. So we'll have a New Mexican hearth with mud-plastered walls, the items used in the New Mexican home. We have a early 19th century Spanish kitchen set up. And then we have an 18th century colonial Mexican kitchen. And so it's hard to pick a favorite object because there's a lot in each area. And then we have an estrado setting, which is really an elegant setting, but the estrado is a tradition that was done throughout the Americas. It's a tradition that comes from Spain. From 800 years of Arabic rule in Spain, there was this tradition of sitting on low cushions and seats around your table where you drink your tea. But in the Spanish colonial world and in Spain, you'd have chocolate. Or in South America, you drink yerba mate. And we have a big section on yerba mate in the exhibit as well, which we just refer to as mate in English. So our estrado setting is a special sitting room, and it's a special time of day called merienda, which is when you have your snack or in between lunch and dinner. And it's all colonial period furniture from Peru, from Argentina, and silver table service, so a silver mate cup, a silver tea kettle. This is probably one of my favorite objects in the show, but there were these hot water kettles used for yerba mate, which had a compartment inside the kettle where you'd keep hot coals, and that would keep your water warm when you were refilling. When you drink yerba mate, you put the leaves loose in your cup instead of in a tea bag. You put the leaves in the cup, and you just keep pouring in that hot water until the flavor is gone. So that would require use of a tea kettle that the water stayed warm in. And they're just wonderful artistic objects as well as being functional. They're just beautiful pieces.
What was the nutritional sustenance of the Spanish and of Indians around the time that they met? In other words, how did they get all the nutrients they needed to be healthy?
Combos of foods. When we have found in the Native American diet, when you're looking at the squash and the beans and the corn, when all of those foods are served together, you're getting 100% of your vitamins and minerals and everything you need. Drinks such as chocolate and yerba mate are really high in antioxidants. Yerba mate has B vitamins, C vitamin, minerals. I think there's folic acid. It was recently named a food by the World Health Organization. Foods being brought over, of course, your protein-rich foods like your meat, your pork coming over, the cheeses, the calciums, that sort of thing. You also had cabbages, lettuces, again, more antioxidants coming in via the garlic and onions coming over, and vegetables such as the cucumber, different items like that coming over. So a very well-balanced diet. And again, we always talk about the evils of sugar and, you know, the Spanish adding sugar to chocolate, but back during this period, sugar was not used the way it is used today. Sugar was used as a spice, the way we use cinnamon or something. So you didn't load on the sugar. You didn't fill your chocolate with sugar. It wasn't the second ingredient on your ingredient list. It was used as a spice more for a light flavoring.
We're talking to Nicolasa Chavez, curator of the New World Cuisine exhibit at the Museum of International Folk Art. Let's say we were to go back 200 years in Santa Fe. How different or similar are the foods that people were eating then to the foods, the New Mexican foods that we're eating now?
I think a lot of the foods were similar. Not so much what you see in the restaurants, not the chile relleno, that sort of item. However, when you're looking at caldillos and stews and beans, chicos is one, the really small corns that are cooked. Oftentimes things that are cooked in the home by grandparents today, I see those as being very similar to that something was, that was probably served 200 years ago. And one example I can think of, growing up, Christmas time every year in my family, we always had these empanaditas, which are, they're like little pasties or what they're called in England, but they were beef tongue empanadas, and it was like a minced meat empanada. And as a kid, I hated these. I could not stand them as a kid. They were my great-grandmother Nicolasa's recipe. So she got that recipe from her parents. And so that's something that would have been served back in the 19th century. That recipe has changed very little. I have an aunt that still makes them today. And I imagine they taste very much like what they tasted like 200 years ago. You caramelize your onions a little bit. You add your beef tongue in there, some raisins. You enclose them in your dough and you cook them, a little bit of spices. And they're little handheld bite-sized pieces, which now I've grown an appreciation for. But as a kid, I remember just not liking these and people saying, well, you have to eat them. They're your great-grandmother's recipe. You know, these have been in the family for years. So So foods like that, and just talking to other people, the stews and the pozoles, for sure, the chicos. And again, I think in northern New Mexico, it was, you know, we had these long, cold winters, not like this year, which
right.
I keep waiting for some snow or some moisture uh-huh. and some winter weather. But the winters were really long, and they were a lot colder, and we had a lot more moisture. Once upon a time in New Mexico, the Rio Grande would freeze over, and caravans could actually travel up the river over the snow and ice. It's hard for us to imagine that today.
Indeed.
So a lot of these foods that made New Mexican cuisine what it is, beans, chicos, pozole, the dried red chili pods, because that could last through the whole winter. That could sustain you, all of those foods. So we had a lot of these warm, hot dishes made out of dried foods at the time. So I imagine those are very similar to a lot of the ones done previously.
There's not food, obviously, in the exhibit because it would go bad and lots of bad things would happen.
Right.
But there's all sorts of events over the next year plus that do involve food.
Yes, yes. So the opening weekend, we're having lots of fun with it. We have a special member preview Friday night, which will be more the Spanish side of things, the Spanish tapas. And again, a lot of those incorporate the tomato and the bell pepper, which are American foods that went over to Spain. You know, a real fun tidbit about Spanish cuisine is they did not take to the hot chilies. The bell peppers were used a lot, but really hot, spicy food. To them, spice is the garlic and the onions, but a lot of Spaniards that I know that come to New Mexico have a hard time with the really spicy. So the opening event will have South American wines, Spanish wines. That's another part of the exhibit.
Right, yeah, we haven't
talked
about history.
Wines. So we'll be serving tapas that night. And then for the public opening on Sunday, which is from 1 to 4, and museum admission is free to New Mexican residents on Sundays, we will be doing chocolate tastings. And Mark Shishinti is going to be showcasing three different chocolate recipes. One will be based on a Mayan recipe, a Yucatan chocolate, and then we'll have a Spanish colonial period chocolate from New Mexico, and then a contemporary Mexican recipe. So for the public event, that'll be a lot of fun. I do believe there will be some New Mexican appetizers and snacks as well. The Women's Board of the Museum of New Mexico hosts the public opening, and I don't know the exact menu, but I've heard through the grapevine they're experimenting with different flavors of taquitos, probably guacamole, different, you know, regional cuisine that will go with the chocolate. And then Monday evening, our member-based group, the Friends of Folk Art, are having a South American night, which is a ticketed event. We'll be doing a lecture on yerba mate with a tasting of yerba mate, and then they'll have some South American cuisine and wine as well. In February, we're going to do a chocolate-specific event again with a lecture and tasting of historic recipes.
And we'll keep people up to date on all of that as it's coming up.
Yeah, and the other really nice thing, Museum Hill Cafe is going to be showcasing a special menu based on the exhibition. So Weldon Fulton has come up with some New World cuisine ideas. I think he has four different pieces he will be including on the new menu, and one of them is a Nopal cactus salad, which I've had the pleasure of tasting and trying.
And
it's,
you look
wonderful.
Very happy about it, yes.
Yes, it's delicious. And there is a corn custard souffle with a poblano chili cream sauce on top that is absolutely fabulous. And a special wine list again with a lot of Spanish and South American wines.
Tell us for just a moment about the wine aspect of this whole New World cuisine.
Yes, well, wine is one of those things that came over from Europe, the grapes and the wine. The Spanish brought the wine into Mexico after Cortes had conquered Mexico, and the first settlers were arriving and landing. There was a decree that they all needed to bring seeds and plants from Spain, including grapevines, and each family was supposed to attempt to grow grapevines. However, in southern Mexico, the climate's too warm and moist for the grapes, so they kept moving further north. And an area north of Zacatecas is called Parras, which means grapevines. And that was the first real establishment of the early vineyards in our part of the world. In South America, Chile, Peru, and the western part of Argentina, the first vineyards were established in 1530, very, very early on. The grapes finally made it up to New Mexico in 1629, brought in by the Franciscan friars who were establishing missions. So we are the earliest wine region in the continental United States. Little known fact. Wine did very well up and down the Rio Grande Valley at a time. And again, we were a lot more moist. We could irrigate fields better at that time. Wine flourished here in New Mexico clear up until the beginning of the 20th century, and flooding was one of the major causes that wiped out wine production in New Mexico.
Amazing.
An odd thing for us to think about. We can't even imagine flooding now.
Right, right.
In 1884, we were the fifth largest wine producer in the U.S.
Amazing. And you have a cooking component to this whole event.
Yes, we do. The Santa Fe School of Cooking is offering courses for the entire run of the show, for the whole year, and based on New World cuisine and the fusion and New Mexican regional cuisine. And 20% of the proceeds from the classes will go back to the museum's educational programs.
Nicolasa Chavez is curator of the New World Cuisine exhibit, which opens this Sunday, the 9th of December, at the Museum of International Folk Art. It'll be up for over a year. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.